Welcome to Follow the Sound. I'm your host, Brian Kroc. Each week, we explore a different aspect of music, including albums, concerts, the artists, or music history, or basically whatever we decide to do that given week. Because we're flexible, and we all like different weird things about music anyway. So, this week, though, we're doing This Week in Music History, as we've been doing for the last several weeks. Our fans seem to be enjoying them thoroughly. Unfortunately, Greg Harvey is busy tonight, and so it's just me and my good friend Jacob Crum. How you doing, Jake?
I'm doing well. The mountains win again, Brian.
Yes, they do. What mountains in Missouri, though? I don't know.
They don't have to be in Missouri. I mean, just the mountains.
Just
they
the mountains
win.
Somewhere.
They win again. They always win.
So, if you like listening to the show and you want to help support the show, though, you can go to our website, followthesoundpodcast.com, and on the right-hand side, you'll see an Amazon banner. Click on the banner. It takes you to Amazon. It's just that simple. You can do all of your normal shopping, except we get a little bit of a cutback because you went through our site. You can also go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon, and it takes you right to Amazon. Shop away. We get a little bit of love. That's how it works. But, yes. So, Jake.
Yes.
You were talking a little bit before. You wanted to do a little plug, right?
Yeah, I did.
Help out a friend, right?
Yeah. Well,
go for it.
Yeah. So, there's another podcast I listen to. It's called Fear the Boot. And one of the co-hosts there, Pat, has cancer, and it sucks. I haven't met Pat personally, but I have met a couple other members at a convention that they do called BootCon, and they're really nice guys. And Pat is a really nice guy. I enjoy his work, and so I just wanted to plug his GoFundMe. If anyone likes to give money to people who need money to fund cancer treatment,
yes,
please check out the links. They'll be in the show notes. It's GoFundMe/Pat has cancer and it sucks. And he's got a little update.
I'm looking at it right now. That is literally what it is. It is GoFundMe.com/Pat has cancer and it sucks.
Yeah, he's got a great sense of humor. And he's also got, I don't have the link for it right in front of me, but he's got another one where he talks about his treatment. It's a little blurb, a little bit of blog. And honestly, it picks me up every day he makes a post. I believe what you're talking about was
let's see, herringbridge.org.
There you go.
/visit/never tell me the odds.
Yeah.
Which is a great Star Wars reference.
Of course it is.
So, yes, if you want to help him out, go to his GoFundMe page, GoFundMe.com/Pat has cancer. And it sucks.
I volunteered to do this little plug. Nobody asked me to do it. I just thought, hey, what the heck? They're St. Louis podcast. I like the guys.
Yeah.
And let's keep Pat well-funded.
Yes, well-funded so he can stay alive and keep fighting and keep producing content. So, and also, I'll just say it just for my personal thing, I'll be praying for you, Pat, because that is pretty much the only thing I can do besides giving money to your GoFundMe page. So I just hope that that you come out of it okay. So, Jake.
Here we go.
Do you know what we also need to do?
What do we need to do?
I would just like to also say thanks to lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to do a show, because that's what they're good at, is producing content and different podcasts and stuff like that. So thank you to lineupmedia.fm, who I work for also. So, all right, but we need to get into our history this week. So I think we got a lovely list of things going on this week, and I know we don't have Greg here, but I was really hoping that Greg would be here for this one, because I'm going back a little bit. I'm breaking the rule. I'm going back a couple days before this Monday,
which is when
we
start.
We do history Monday through Friday. We don't include Saturday or Sunday because, you know, it's like then we want something else to talk about next year. But this year, on the 11th, this last weekend, the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones released, let's face it, 20 years ago.
20 years ago
on Saturday. That is crazy. It's like I don't even remember. Like I remember the album being out. I remember them using songs like in 100 different 90s movies
and commercials.
And commercials. And I remember going to see the Boss Tones at Mississippi Nights.
Ah.
And the Pie Tasters opened for them. And I remember the Pie mm-hmm. Tasters, like, because they were like from Washington and like they were really cool. But yeah, the Boss Tones did their whole shtick, doing the whole thing. Dickie Barrett up on stage. And at the end of the show, literally, Dickie Barrett jumps out into the crowd, walks through the crowd right past me, and puts his hand on my shoulder as he's going by. And then went like straight back to the merch table. And so Dickie Barrett has touched my shoulder.
Well, it's more, he's touched more of you than he has of me.
Yes, that is true.
Only my heart, I suppose.
But yes, that was one of those albums that was incredibly influential and like was probably like one of the biggest ska albums to ever be released, right?
At least in the U.S.
At least in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the Specials outsold them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they might have collectively because they've been around long enough. But,
mm-hmm. but let's get actually on to our real days of the week where we do our history. So let's go to March 13th. And Jake, I think you got the first one on this one.
I do. 1959, Friday the 13th, the Kingston Trio has chartered a chartered plane to take them to Notre Dame to play a show. And it's forced to land from complications in Goshen, Indiana, at a turkey farm.
Goshen?
Goshen, Indiana.
Wow.
So they parked, waited for some police to show up to take them to a bus stop, where then they bought a case of beer and bribed someone, who a truck driver, to take them to Notre Dame.
Wow. You want to know something funny, though?
What's that?
I really don't know that much about the Kingston Trio.
Really?
Yeah. The only thing I know about the Kingston Trio is that there was a dude in the Kingston Trio who is a past member who named John Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
And here's my weird story about John Stewart. So Jessica, my wife, is a big fan of John Stewart. There's okay. one particular reason why. Lindsey Buckingham of Fleetwood Mac, the guitar player and singer and songwriter and producer and all of that for Fleetwood Mac, was a big fan of John Stewart. So because Lindsey was a big fan of John Stewart, Jessica became a big fan of John Stewart. So John Stewart played the banjo in the Kingston Trio.
Okay.
Lindsey learned to play guitar by listening to John play the banjo and then mimicked the banjo style on guitar. Mm. When John Stewart wanted to learn how to play guitar to release an album, he listened to Lindsey Buckingham to learn how to play guitar, which means John taught Lindsey, who taught John, in the exact same style.
not bad.
Boom.
Here's what
weird
I
connection.
Know.
He actually has some really good albums, and I think you would love them.
Lindsey?
No. Well, I think you like some Lindsey albums, but I think you'd love John Stewart albums.
Oh, okay.
Because they're a little bit trippy. They're country, but they're not too country. Like, they're folksy,
mm-hmm.
just good quality Americana music.
So. Here's what I know about the Kingston Trio.
Go ahead.
Is that they were kind of the bad boys of folk music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is kind of hilarious when you think
about... Well, that's the way John Stewart is,
so... Well, fair enough.
Well, was.
Right. But in an interview that Bob Shaw gave, he retold the story of the plane landing.
Yes.
And in his account, they spent the better part of the morning drinking a fifth of whiskey, got completely lit, went up on the plane, didn't realize they had landed until they hit the ground.
Yeah.
Never knew anything was going wrong. Then bought a case of beer, got drunk on the way up to Notre Dame, walked into Notre Dame, and a priest walked up to him and said, "I understand that you guys like to do blues sometime, so we're not going to go for that here. If you get vulgar in any way, we're going to shut the sound off on you, and that'll be the end of the show." So then Bob Shaw goes up on stage and says that, tells everyone the story, and somebody out in the crowd yells, "Bullshit!" And the crowd laughed like crazy, and then the show, they just did whatever they wanted. And then like 30 years later, he found out that was a friend of his that showed up to the show and never said hi to them because he thought it was hilarious.
That's great.
All so from the guys who sang Tom Dooley.
At least the Kingston Trio, you know, made it out alive from their emergency landing. So that was good. And moving on to 1961, the Temptations auditioned for Motown Records. They were then known as the Elgins or the Elgins. I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce that. But they changed their name to the Temptations, and now they've become the worldwide, massively selling group that we know them to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was good. We talked a little bit about Motown last week, too, which was quite nice. But moving on, 1964, and I loved this. This was one of those facts that I found out and was like, ooh, that's actually really interesting. In 1964, Billboard reported that the sales of Beatles singles currently accounted for 60% of the total U.S. singles sold in America.
Wow.
And let's see, their album Meet the Beatles reached a record 3.5 million copies sold.
That I mean, for a single, that's not an LP either.
Yeah.
It's not a studio album.
Wow. Crazy.
So if anybody wants to know,
60% of the singles market was the Beatles at one time.
So the answer to the question of why don't singles or albums for that matter sell in America anymore, it's because the Beatles aren't making music, I guess, right?
But surprisingly, though, a year from that, the Beatles actually released 8 Days a Week, which hit number one off, you know, on the charts. It's crazy, man. Beatles just tearing it up for a good few years there.
I wonder, okay, so
go ahead.
So John Lennon said that they were more popular than Jesus Christ. I wonder what Bible sales for that same year looked like. Like, did their singles actually outsell the Bible? I bet it did.
I don't know, man. People buy Bibles in bulk, so.
Oh, that's fair enough.
You know, I mean, like, look at Gideon's alone.
Right.
They're giving out Bibles left and right. So let's see here. In 1965, Eric Clapton, complaining that the band was becoming too commercial, leaves the Yardbirds. Yep, that happened. That's just funny to me. The Yardbirds were like one of those groups, though, that like a bunch of people played for and then left and then, you know, became popular in other bands. But it's just funny to me that Clapton was like, nope, you guys are becoming too commercial. I need to leave this crap.
Yeah, the Yardbirds were kind of like the Roger Corman Studios of the music industry. Like, they just kept bringing in talent and, like, pushing them other places.
Oh, God, Roger Corman. All right, so in 1968, the Byrds' greatest hits became certified gold. I think it's amazing that by 1968, they even had a greatest hits album.
How long were they playing for at that point?
They'd been playing together for a good few years, but it was still just like, I mean, it was the Byrds. I mean, they'd been around for like 4 or 5 years at least. I know that much. I could look it up, but I'm not going to. The Byrds were always just a funny group to me because they like really didn't seem to take themselves that seriously. They were just like, we're just playing, we're having fun.
Yeah.
But here we go. I'm going to jump forward. I completely skip past the 70s because nothing good ever happened in the 70s on March 13th. But moving up to 1988,
ooh.
Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up.
Never Gonna Give You Up.
Hits number one in the U.S. And, you know, it's really funny because they the video shows, you know, Rick running around London and stuff. And, you know, massive hit for him. Everybody who listens to him on the radio thinks that he's some black guy, and then they see the video and it's like some tall, skinny, redheaded dude with a baritone voice, and it just people went crazy over him. But he didn't get a follow up. Obviously, mm-hmm. he didn't hit number two on the charts. But go ahead 2 more decades. And his song becomes insanely popular again with Rick rolling
on
YouTube. And he earned like a total of $11 from then.
That's kind of terrible.
That
I
is
guess.
Horrible.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it also kind of rekindled his career. And he released an album this last year. And I'm totally going to review it.
I literally know nothing about the man other than that song.
He's an interesting cat. You should check him out sometime. He's kind of interesting because of just the path that he took after the 80s.
Turkey farmer.
Like he kind of like just he gave up music, was like, I'm done for a while. And then he like decided, you know what? I'm going to come back. I'm going to do some like small shows and stuff around London. And it's like Rick Astley, you know, doing a show. It's like for the first time in however long, and like sold out instantly. And so like he sells out everywhere he goes in the UK. In America, I'm sure it'd be a little bit harder for him to sell. But But in the UK, he sells out like everywhere.
I bet that he could put together a show in the US if he got some comedy groups to go with him, like get Tenacious D and the Lonely Island, and then, you know, come out, sing one song. The headliner sings one song for like 35 minutes, just straight, never going to give you up for 35 minutes. And people would buy tickets to that.
That would be very interesting. So let's see. Let's move on up. 2002. Oh, Jake, you got one.
2002.
Do it.
Danny Bonaducci has a celebrity boxing match with Barry Williams. The Partridge Family versus the Brady Bunch.
Which one was Barry Williams again?
I have. I think it was the littlest one. It was the two, like, the two children, right?
Oh, I got to look this one up. Barry Williams.
Are you a Partridge? You're a Partridge Family guy, right?
No, I was actually more of a. Oh, he was Greg.
Ah, okay.
He was Greg Brady. He was the oldest.
Well,
there you go. So I was always more of a Brady Bunch fan than I was a Partridge Family. Partridge Family always seemed kind of forced to me.
As opposed to the effortless comedy of the Brady Bunch.
Well, no. I mean, because it was like, oh, it's a musical family.
Yeah.
It's like, in the 60s, let's capitalize on this, you know. It's like the Brady Bunch wasn't a musical group until they were just like, yeah, let's go ahead and make them play some music. you know, but for some reason, the Partridge Family, I mean, but then again, I mean, we talked about it before. I will always be a Monkees fan
over any of those. That's the correct answer to that question. Partridge Family, Brady Bunch, the Monkees.
The Monkees, exactly. So, but it's still just funny that Danny Bonaducci fought.
Well, I mean, Family versus fought Brady in quotations.
Bunch boxing match.
Yeah.
But didn't he win? Didn't Danny win?
Yeah, if you can call it winning, I don't even consider it a contest.
He's a strapping lad. I mean, and he's got that whole Irish heritage.
Well, so that's true. Like, that's true.
Like going into the boxing. So, but that's funny. Oh, I got one for you. 2004. Luciano Pavarotti makes his 379th and last performance at the Met Opera in New York City.
Mm.
He played the painter Mario Cavaradossi. Yeah, that's right. I can speak Italian. In Giacomo Puccini's Tosca, he received a 12-minute standing ovation.
You know what? First and last time I've ever cared about opera.
They called him the king of the high seas. That's 2 weeks in a row that I brought up opera singers.
Yes.
That's what you expect. I like opera.
Okay.
Most people don't know that.
I don't understand why they can't sing it in a language other than Italian.
Well, I mean, they've got a bunch of American operas, as we will get to.
Okay.
Or at least English-speaking operas. Or operettas. That's the other one that they like to do. I actually don't know the difference between an opera and an operetta, other than, I guess, it's shorter.
I would assume length.
So it's like you know, when you talk about a rhapsody. Rhapsody is three parts. That's why Bohemian Rhapsody is three separate parts.
Yeah.
It's like, I didn't know what a rhapsody was until much later on. I thought it was like a style of music, but it turns out it's just the pacing of the song. So, let's see. You got another one.
Yeah, 2006, Isaac Hayes quits South Park. Thoughts?
Why did he quit South Park, Jake?
Well, officially, the official press release statement was that he was upset over the Scientology episode.
Yes. Which I've actually been watching, like, Leah Remini's whole Scientology show.
Yes, amazing.
Like, mind-blowing.
Yes.
Like, it's people talk about the Church of Scientology like it's a cult.
Mm-hmm.
That is not a cult. That is a mob. Like, that is a mafia. And, like, they are super powerful. It's just like the mafia did with Sinatra, Scientology does with Tom Cruise. That's all I'm saying.
As you'll find out here, Isaac Hayes as well. Because he didn't make that statement. His entourage made that statement after he had had a stroke.
Oh.
And they took advantage of his weakened state where he wasn't paying attention to things other than getting healthy, and they quit South Park for him.
Well, you know, what's funny, though, is that they actually say that L. Ron Hubbard died of a stroke.
Really?
Yeah.
But he's coming back. I mean, that's why that's why we keep offices.
That's what David Miscavige says.
He's coming back.
But I don't think it's going to happen because, you know, basically he died and they were kind of saying that L. Ron Hubbard couldn't die. So how did he die? So, you know, they spun it, though. And if you watch the show, they spun it to where they said, you know, oh, He let his body go. And he willed his body to die so he could become a spirit.
Right.
Like, that's how they spun it. Instead of just, he had a stroke and died because that's what humans do.
Mm-hmm.
So, wow. Either way, Isaac Hayes, he did have a great music career, and he did have a great career on South Park. And I also loved the fact that South Park did not back down.
No.
At all. So, I went back and I rewatched that episode, and it cracked me up even more.
And kudos to his son, who's been talking about how Scientology treated his father at the end of his life when he was sick and ill.
Yeah.
Afterwards. That's where this all came from, was from an interview he had done. So,
moving on to 2013, Ken Casey of the Dropkick Murphys takes out a skinhead fan after seeing him raise a Nazi salute. A crowd had gathered on stage for an encore, and seeing the fan across the stage, Casey hit him, knocked him to the floor, and laid into him, and then calmly returned to his base. Casey proclaimed, "Nazis are not welcome at a Dropkick Murphys show."
You and your racist friend.
So, you know what's bad? I totally don't know that many. I know like 3 Dropkick Murphy songs. I've never actually listened to one of the albums. I might have to do that
sometime. Can't say I'm a gigantic fan of theirs either.
But we have friends that are huge fans
that's true,
of theirs.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just, it cracks me up that they're always talking about it. And, you know, but we've never actually put into it. Moving on to March 14th. In 1885, going back, not
what?
The oldest history fact I've done, because I did one in the 1600s, but...
Was that the invention of the hurdy-gurdy?
No, it was the early 1700s, that's what it was. It was way, way back then, in the 1700s, it was the first American opera opened up.
Mm.
So, this one, however, in 1885, Gilbert and Sullivan's comic opera Mikado premiered in London at the Savoy Theatre.
Ah.
Very famous theater.
Yes.
Very, very famous theater. But Gilbert and Sullivan, of course, are well known for their comedic operettas and goofy songs that people listen to and their absolute blatant racism.
Well, you know what?
Including the Mikado.
I was really surprised. I had never heard any of the songs from the Mikado. And before the show, Brian played one for me because he's like, "I can't believe you haven't heard this." But, you know, for 1896?
1885.
Gonna say maybe not screaming racist, just moderate. You know?
Well, let's put it this way. If it were done in today's society, they would say
absolutely.
That it's the most racist thing of all time. I'm pretty sure a few social justice warriors' heads would explode.
My head would probably explode. I mean, if people were buying tickets to it, my head would explode, yeah.
I do gotta say, though, that... One of my favorite comedy groups, Mitchell and Webb.
Yes.
From the UK.
Yes.
From that Mitchell and Webb look.
Mm-hmm.
Or the Mitchell and Webb look. They did a bunch of Gilbert and Sullivan failed operas.
Yes.
And they were hilarious.
Yes.
But the one that ended up actually like being good was they decided to basically just make an absolutely racist opera. And of course, everybody loved it again. So... But yeah, if you get a chance, check them out on YouTube, Mitchell and Webb failed operas, and you'll laugh your head off.
I want them to come back and do an entire 30-minute show of Sir Digby Chicken Caesar.
That's number Wang.
That's number Wang.
Okay. If you haven't watched the show ever, you will not get those jokes at all. But please go and watch it. It is honestly one of the best comedy series I have ever come across. Sketch comedy. Like, it's just brilliant, brilliant stuff. All right. So, moving on. Let's see. Jake, I think you got another one for me.
We're still on March 14th?
Yeah. We just did 1885, Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh, yes. Okay, here we go.
So then we got to jump
forward. We're jumping way up there.
Way up there.
More than half a century to 1958. And we have the first gold record ever recorded.
Yes.
Perry Como's.
Perry Como.
Well, excuse me. The first gold record stamped.
So here's what it is that Perry Como, Catch a Falling Star, was the one that was given a gold record.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was is that many years before that, They gave a gold record to Glenn Miller for Chattanooga Choo Choo.
Yes.
And that was just sort of like a publicity stunt. It wasn't until much, much later on with this that it actually became an industry standard. And so Perry Como's Catch a Falling Star was the first to be given an industry standard gold record. And it was like, you know, the actual like metallic looking gold record as opposed to just a spray painted gold record, which is what they gave Glenn Miller.
Yeah. Are you a fan of Catch a Falling Star?
I actually have not listened to it. At least if I have, I don't remember it.
Well, Catch a Falling Star and Put It in Your Pocket.
Oh, that's what that one is.
Yeah.
Catch a Falling Star and put it in your pocket. Yeah. I know that one. Moving ahead to 1963, Cliff Richard and the Shadows were at number one on the UK singles chart with Summer Holiday. I threw this one in just for my dad. Because we're all going on a summer holiday.
Is that your favorite summer song?
No. What it is that my dad, like, Cliff Richard was basically Elvis in the UK.
Okay.
And because, you know, Elvis was Elvis and Cliff Richard was Cliff Richard.
And Elvis played a song in London.
Yes, that's true.
Or a concert. Never played a concert in London.
So Cliff Richard had the pop hits. And he had the movies, just like Elvis. Even had similar hair to Elvis. But he was British. And so he did this song, Summer Holiday, which was taken from the movie of the same name, just like they did with a bunch of Elvis songs, which is basically about a bunch of guys who go on a summer holiday to go pick up some girls.
Okay.
That's the entire movie. And it's really goofy and it's really not like great, but my dad likes the movie a lot. And so, and he'll sing that line of Summer Holiday at the drop of a hat. Like if you say anything about going on a trip somewhere, he'll be like, we're all going on a summer holiday. It's that simple.
Okay, then.
Moving up another year to 1964. For the first time in British recording history, all top 10 singles in the UK were British acts. Starting at number one, Anyone Who Had a Heart by Cilla Black, Bits and Pieces by the Dave Clark Five, Little Children by Billy J. Kramer, Diane by The Bachelors, Not Fade Away by The Rolling Stones, Just One Look by The Hollies. I love that song. Just one look, and I fell hard in love. It's a good one. I like that. Let's see. Needles and Pins by The Searchers, another really good one. I Think of You by The Mercy Beats. Boys Cry by Eden Kane. And at number 10, Let Me Go, Lover by Kathy Kirby. I know, like, most of those. I don't know all of them.
I thought The Searchers was a John Wayne movie. I didn't know that was a music act.
No, Needles and Pins. It's a really goofy song. So, but I actually do know that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I watched a bunch of the Top of the Pops. Like, you can get, like, where they've just got the performances on DVD.
Yeah.
And so that's, like, all I watched. And back in the 60s, just cracked me up. Moving up to 1983, John Bon Jovi, Richie Sambora, and Alec John. Who is it? Such? I don't know. I don't know how to say that.
Such. For now, it's Such.
Formed Bon Jovi, which, of course, you know, went on to write some very, very good songs.
And New Jersey has never been the same.
New Jersey has never been the same. Moving on up to 1995, with the release of Me Against the World, Tupac Shakur became the first male solo artist to have a number one album on the Billboard charts while in prison.
Can't keep a good man down.
Nope, unless you shoot him multiple times in a Vegas street.
What are you talking about? Pac's not dead.
Yes, he is.
No.
Yes, he is. He's totally dead. I got a friend who was there. He knows. And if anybody from my office hears that, they'll know what I'm talking about. Moving to March 15th. Ooh. Got a couple of things all right in a row here. 1955, Elvis Presley signed a management contract with Colonel Tom Parker. But Jake, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to jump up to 1958 real quick before I go back down. Uh-oh. What happened in 1958 with Elvis?
1958, Elvis plays his last concert before joining the army and doesn't play another concert for 11 years.
Man.
Can you imagine that? I think there were a couple of like charity benefits he might have done something at, like a song or a couple of songs, but he never did a concert where he sold tickets for 11 years.
Basically, though, he was stationed in Germany, and I think he was a tank driver.
Okay, if you say so.
I want to say that's true. Elvis fans, if I'm wrong, please correct me. You can find us on Facebook at Follow the Sound Podcast or on Twitter at I Follow the Sound. I will respond to anything if you post it. But yeah, I'm pretty sure he was involved in tanks and stuff like that in Germany because he never saw combat.
Yeah. They weren't going to let him.
I mean, there was some stuff going on in the 50s, obviously. Like in the early 50s, there was like the Korean War.
Yeah.
But I don't think he joined in 58, the Korean War wasn't going on at that time. So, I mean, basically, there was no real conflicts going on, so he wasn't going to be seeing any combat. And even if there was combat, you know they weren't going to let him do that. That was not going to happen. But let's see. Going back a little bit, also in 1955, Ray Charles peaks at number 2 on the U.S. R&B charts with the Atlantic single, I Got a Woman.
I don't know that one.
Really?
No.
You don't know I Got a Woman?
No.
I got a woman way over town who's good to me. Oh, yeah. Really? You don't know that one?
No.
That one's great. That's a good song.
Okay.
So it was widely regarded as the first soul album, or the first soul record, because he took the song from a old gospel song and kind of converted it into a secular song. It's pretty good. So if you have not heard that one, then you absolutely need to listen to it.
I need to just listen to more rhythm and blues in general.
You do. You need to listen to more of the old school stuff. So let's see. Moving on to what? 1972.
Ooh, 1972. You're going to love this, Brian.
What you got?
A small radio station in L.A. with the call letters of KHJ broadcast for 90 minutes Puppy Love.
No.
Yes. They've 90
and
continuous.
They called it Puppy Love.
For 90 continuous minutes, listeners called the police. They were worried that something was happening, and they realized that the only law that was broken was bad taste, so they continued to play for another 60 minutes.
So I don't understand that, like why people would think that something was necessarily wrong, because most of the record players don't have like a repeat function. it plays and then
that's
it
true.
Stops.
That's true.
You know, of which even back then, I mean, I know radio DJs had to be careful, especially on like overnight stuff, because you'd put on a record, close your eyes for a second, and the next thing you know, there's silence.
Right.
So. And not even silent, because it just... So, yeah. But seriously, for 90 minutes, they
90
played
straight
Puppy
minutes,
Love.
Yeah. As a publicity stunt, and
good
I guess apparently it worked.
Donny Osmond, man.
But here, an interesting side note. So, that radio station now is currently owned in part by the Catholic Church. And it's a subsidiary country called Immaculate Heart Radio. And also, they broadcast in Echo Park, California.
Every year, they play 90 minutes of Puppy Love.
Mm-hmm. So, while Tom Waits was recording Closing Time, Puppy Love, 90 minutes.
There you go. So, let's see, moving on. 1975, the Doobie Brothers went to number 1 on the U.S. singles charts with Black Water, the group's first of 2 U.S. number 1s. The only problem is the only line that I know of Blackwater is "Oh Blackwater." I think keep on rolling, keep on rolling, Mississippi shining on, something like that. That's the only. And I've actually seen the Doobie Brothers live. I gotta say, those dudes still put on a killer show. Almost like I don't know, like it's kind of hard to compare them. Because I've seen like some really fabulous live shows of bands like going back to the 70s and stuff, including like Earth, Wind & Fire with like Chicago. And so like but it's in that vein. They put on a really, really good show.
Interesting note. For whatever reason, when I was a kid, I had the Bee Gees and the Doobie Brothers confused. So anytime anyone mentioned the Doobie Brothers, I thought they were talking about the Bee Gees.
You know what I loved about when I saw the Doobie Brothers this last year, though?
What's that?
They opened with Jesus Is Just All Right. Jesus is just all right with me.
I had a homeless guy randomly sing that song at me on a train in L.A.
Nice.
And he did pretty well. Like, he went through about 6 or 7 bars of it.
All right. And then to close out March 15th, I believe we got something
1976,
major.
1976, Kiss releases Destroyer.
Yes. And? Yeah.
And that's an album.
Did it destroy?
I don't think so, because we still have radio stations. An EMP blast did not go off and close down the grid. So, pretty much.
Okay, so I know what Destroyer is. It, you know, it's got, what, Detroit Rock City, Beth. And
Shout It Out Loud.
Shout It Out Loud. Shout it.
Shout it.
Shout it out loud. Oh, man. That's one of my favorites, so.
Is it?
Yeah, for Shout It Out Loud, it's one of my favorite Kiss songs.
I think my favorite Kiss song is War Machine.
Yeah?
Because Gene Simmons sings it. And
yeah, for a second, I got confused. And I was like, mm-hmm. War Pigs, that's not.
No, no, it's not. No.
No.
You better watch out. I'm a war machine.
That's a pretty good Gene Simmons.
Thanks. It's it's not a really great song. It's just, it's so campy and ridiculous that I enjoy it.
I want to do a review of a Kiss album, and I think Destroyer might be a good one. I'm bringing
not
in,
Love Gun.
We could do Love Gun too.
Okay,
but
well, I was just
actually I'm not even going to pick the album because I'm bringing in one of my coworkers.
Ooh, okay.
His name is Corey, and Corey is a huge Kiss fan, and I mean, like, he's got Kiss bobbleheads on the front of his desk, and like. He wants to, like, name his kid Beth and stuff.
Oh, jeez. All right. Please bring him in because I got to talk him out of that. I have to.
That's not going to happen. He's also a massive wrestling fan.
Yeah.
And the host of a show called The Three Horsemen with two other co-workers.
Yeah.
Where they do nothing but discuss wrestling, okay, old and new.
You have to give me his number because at some point we're going to get him in here to review the Macho Man Randy Savage rap album.
Sure. I'll mark that one down.
Be a man, Hulk.
All right. Moving on to March 16th. Jake, I think you got another one for me in 1945.
Yes, 1945. On March 15th, here we go. Rum and Coca-Cola peaked at number one by the Andrews Sisters. Brian, are you familiar with the Andrews Sisters?
I am familiar with the Andrews Sisters, mainly just because they did... let's see, what, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy?
From Company B.
Yeah, which is, like, obviously their most famous song. Right. Very, very
and
popular back in the
Greg
1940s.
Here, we could possibly do the trio and actually try the harmonies.
That would be hilarious to hear us actually try to, like, plan out a harmony part and stuff.
Which one of us do you think is the counter? Okay, well, hold up. Classic female vocal stylings are soprano... counter soprano and no counter lato and something else.
Well, I mean alto.
Yeah. Oh, that's it.
Yeah. So I don't know which. I'm definitely not a soprano.
No, I'm a terrible falsettist. So
I could possibly. I mean, I can do tenor. That's like that's kind of like my vein. You know, is between bass and tenor.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no way I'm doing alto. Just that's not happening. But I think Greg could get some of the high notes.
Okay.
We just have to figure it out from there. Just have to drop it down a couple of octaves.
Are you? Have
but,
you ever heard?
Yes, I'm very familiar with the Andrews Sisters. They were very, very good at coming up with those harmony parts and just writing catchy tunes.
They had a very long career for being a group who started in Boogie Woogie.
Yes,
and then Boogie Woogie dying.
Yes,
you know, because they started recording in the 20s.
Yeah.
And, you know, Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy came out in like 43 or something.
Yeah.
So, and they kept on through
the
50s.
They started when they were kids.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's how they had such a long career. It's the same thing with like, the Carpenter family. You know, it's like just kept going for a very, very long time.
For anyone who's listening, if you don't know the Andrews Sisters, anytime you've ever seen a movie where there are three women doing harmony singing into a single microphone, they're doing the Andrews Sisters.
Yeah, they're doing a parody or a tribute to the Andrews Sisters. Good stuff.
Sweethearts of the Armed Forces Radio.
Yes, they were. In 1964, the Beatles set a new record for advanced sales in the U.S. with 20... No, that's good. I don't know. With 2.1 million copies of their latest single, Can't Buy Me Love. When pressed by American journalists in 1966 to reveal the song's true meaning, Sir Paul McCartney stated, "I think you can put any interpretation you want on anything, but when someone suggests that Can't Buy Me Love is about a prostitute, I draw the line." I think it's, he can have whatever, you know, interpretation he wants to it. My interpretation of it is that, you know, it's like he says, money can't buy me love. It's like money can get you a lot of things, mm-hmm. but it can't give you happiness in life.
Well, it wouldn't be the first number one song about a prostitute that's hit the radio.
True.
Because Rum and Coca-Cola was about a mother and daughter prostitute team.
Yes, it was.
But anyway.
But they cleaned it up.
Yeah, they did
American
a lot.
Audiences.
A lot.
So let's see here. 1968, they posthumously released Otis Redding's single, Ooh. Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, mm-hmm. and started a 5-week run at number one on the U.S. chart, at number three in U.K. Otis was killed in a plane crash on the 10th of December, 1967, 3 days after recording the song Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Man.
And it became the first posthumous number one single in U.S. chart history and sold over 4 million copies worldwide.
What a song. I mean, yep. really. And just vocal talent as well. I mean.
Yeah. No, I mean, and it's such a brilliant, simple song. Mm-hmm. And it was completely different from everything that he'd recorded up yeah. to that point, which is what made it so special. And they were actually talking about it that the whistling part at the end was actually supposed to be replaced.
Really?
Yeah. It was he just recorded it because he wanted the melody, and mm-hmm. then he was going to go back and like record you know, more lyrics or something, like sort of a close to the song. But after he died, and then they were like there, and they were like, actually, that's pretty cool, you know, like the fact that he's like whistling is like, we'll just fade this out, and it's like he's sitting there, and then all of a sudden he's done singing, and he's just whistling away. It's like it really, really fit, and it was a great close mm-hmm. to his life. It was a great final song to go out on, you know, and that's what I liked about it.
What I love about the song is how effortless the vocals are.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, it kind of makes me think differently about an approach to singing,
which is one of those things too. It's like Otis Redding and like Wilson Pickett.
Mm-hmm.
These guys just had a gift for singing that was like pure God-given mm-hmm. talent.
I would throw Marvin Gaye into that as well.
Marvin Gaye, definitely. But even if you look at how simple that song is for Otis Redding, for Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, it's incredibly deceptive.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen people try to sing it, and they just can't, because you can't do certain runs the right way vocally unless you're really, really trying.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll yeah. away. Like, it's hard to actually do that. I'm amazed that I even just did that.
Just on a go.
Like, I didn't even practice that.
If you went for a second chorus,
that was like
you
the best I've ever sung that song. That was amazing. I couldn't redo that again if I tried. So. But yeah, amazing, amazing talent and an amazing artist. And that was a great, great song. So moving on, though, we got another one. We got another Elvis one today.
Mm.
And I think we got one more after this, too. In 1974, Elvis Presley played the first of four nights at the Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis, Tennessee. This was the first time Elvis had played in Memphis since 1961.
Wow.
Which is crazy, considering that's where he got his start.
Yeah.
So.
You know what I just realized?
He didn't like going back to places.
No, he didn't.
He's like, nope, already played there. Moving on. What'd you just realize?
I think we've mentioned Elvis as much as we've mentioned the Beatles today, which is fitting.
That is fitting. I've been trying to kind of stay away from the Beatles stuff.
Yeah.
Mainly because, like I've said before, they literally did something every week.
Right.
Every week. they did something different. A different song was released. They did some television appearance. They did something. They played somewhere, blah, blah, blah. I mean, they had a good long while of playing.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happens that when we first started doing the show, that it was like the first time that they'd ever played the Cavern Club,
yeah,
which is like a huge deal. And so, you know, doing the music history thing, we just started at the wrong time for Beatles stuff. It's like because every Beatles thing happened apparently right now, and we're just moving on. But we've even got another Beatles reference later on down the line too. So, but yeah, so there you go. Elvis played in Memphis for the first time since 1961.
Mm. We go to 1979 now?
Go to 1979.
1979, CBS airs a documentary about the band Wings, and it's called Wings Over the World. I had never heard of this until now.
Really? You never heard of Wings?
No, the band Wings, yeah. Like, I bought their entire discography for my mom for like a stocking stuffer or some Christmas, you know.
So, yeah, but you know, they did a documentary on Wings, mm-hmm. doing one of their tours, and it was, I don't know, it was cool, kind of interesting to see because it was Paul McCartney without the Beatles.
Yeah.
And so you actually got to see, you know, this big process that he went through, and his band was really impressive. And even today, Paul McCartney is one of the best shows I've ever seen.
Really?
Yeah. Seen him twice now. I saw mm-hmm. him in Milwaukee, and I saw him here when he came to St. Louis.
Was that the stadium show?
Yeah, both were stadium shows. He played at Miller Park in Milwaukee, and he mm-hmm. played at Busch Stadium here in St. Louis. And it's not like I was super close at all.
Yeah.
But he gets out there, and he seriously plays like 50 songs.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, and he hits all the major ones that he did, does some of his newer stuff, does his old stuff, and every time he does Live and Let Die, it's just amazing. Because he's like... You know, mm-hmm.
as
like,
long as he,
da, da, da,
as long as he stays
to
away,
live and let die, boom, fireworks and explosions and fire coming out of the stage. And then it's like, just, yeah, it's incredible.
As long as he leaves out that Christmas song.
Which one?
Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time.
No, he didn't do that.
Thank
but he
God.
He did the birthday one.
Mm-hmm. That song.
Da, 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 da,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's your birthday.
Okay, that's fine. That Christmas did song that though makes me like, it's literally like pins and needles going.
And
in
he
my
did
ears.
He did like Yesterday, and he did Blackbird, mm-hmm. and you know all the
Blackbird
is such a good song.
What a good song.
I love that one, and I even love hearing people do covers of Blackbird, yeah. just because it's such a
Sitting
cool melody.
In the dead of night.
Yeah.
Boy, yeah, that's a good song.
All right. So, moving up to 1991, and this is sad, seven members of country singer Reba McEntire's band and her road manager were among 10 people killed when the private jet crashed in California just north of the Mexican border.
Yeah.
They had played a private show at for IBM, actually, the night before, and so Reba wasn't on the plane with them. But the band and her manager were on the plane, and it crashed, went down, and took out seven members and the manager. It's crazy.
I don't remember that being in the news when it happened, but I do
but
remember.
We were also young.
Well, I mean, that's true, but I remember.
I was nine, so you were nine, too.
Yeah, but it was a year or so before she even played a show after that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a while, and I remember it was like
a
TV
event. It's a hard loss, you know? It's like, to lose all those members of your band.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and like, especially if you've toured with them mm-hmm. for a long time, I mean, that's pretty insane. And then actually moving on to another sort of depressing thing, in 1995, Eazy-E released a statement announcing that he had AIDS, and also that he had yeah. fathered seven children with six different women, and then he died 10 days later.
Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Yeah, that was pretty intense. I mean, I wasn't like a huge fan of Eazy-E, like back then at least. I've gained more respect for him later on. But yeah, it was still just, I remember when it popped up because they're like, you know, it's like rapper and pioneer Eazy-E. It's like died of AIDS, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, oh God. Just, yeah. It was a weird time in the 90s.
Yeah.
But moving on to March 17th, I got it, the final Elvis reference of the night.
Ooh.
1957, Elvis Presley bought the Graceland mansion from Mrs. Ruth Brown Moore for $102,000.
What?
$102,500.
What?
The 23-room, 10,000-square-foot home on 13.8 acres of land would be expanded to 17,552 square feet of living space before the king moved in a few weeks later. The original building had at one time been a place of worship used by the Graceland Christian Church and was named after the builder's daughter, Grace Toof.
I never knew that.
Never knew that at all.
But that is so fitting for Elvis to move into
a place that was a church at one point.
Just good old gospel. Got to bring it home.
Yeah. And it was named the Graceland Christian Church.
Yeah.
And so that's how it got the name Graceland. I never knew that. And it was named after an actual person.
Yeah.
I always figured it was just like, you know, this is the land of grace. We shall call this Graceland. It's like, but no, it was named after a person. And yeah, it's just insane. I've actually never been to Graceland.
Really?
Yeah. I've been to the place where Elvis was born in Tupelo, Mississippi, but I've not been to Graceland. I'd like to go one of these days. I was actually just in Memphis, so it would be nice to head on down that way again for just a little vacation. But yeah, it's kind of amazing just to think.
Just to think that that house wasn't already big enough.
And he had to add on 7,000 square feet.
Yeah, I need another 7,000 square feet before I move in.
Elvis needs some leather leopard prints in one room. Make that 900 square feet.
Just add that 900 on. Square feet of print.
900 square feet.
Maybe that's what it was. Maybe none of that was Elvis. It was what other people
thought Elvis
thought
wanted.
He wanted. Yeah,
that's quite possible too. But yeah, no, it's one of those things. It's still $102,000. Like
yeah.
Back in that day, like I mean, that was a lot of money. So
wow.
So my dad likes to joke that my middle name is Aaron because of Elvis, because his name was Elvis Aaron Presley.
Yeah, he found that out afterwards, didn't he?
No, it wasn't that. It's just that they had a couple of different choices, and then they just finally decided on Aaron as opposed to something else.
That's just what came off the pen when I wrote it down.
Moving ahead to 1967, Jimi Hendrix releases Purple Haze.
Mm.
Running Through My Brain. It's a good one, man.
Yeah, it is.
It's one of my favorite Jimi Hendrix songs. I don't fully grasp the meaning of it, but apparently it's got something to do with being hazy in your brain. Let's see, moving on. 1968, the Bee Gees appear on the Ed Sullivan Show, making their first appearance on American TV. The Brothers Gibb.
Not the Doobie Brothers.
The Bee Gees.
The Bee Gees.
The Doobie Brothers aren't actually brothers, though. That's the...
Okay.
That's the funny part. The Bee Gees are brothers. Yeah. Or at least they were, you know.
But. That's why I was confused. There we go.
So, yeah. No, but their first appearance on American TV. I tried to find a clip of it. I could not find one, like, their first American performance. But it is what it is. Moving forward to 1978, an Irish band in high school, who had just recently changed their name from The Hype, won a Limerick Civic Week Pop 1978 talent competition, earning them about $1,000 and a chance to record a demo for CBS Records. That band was U2.
Yeah. Yeah, it was.
So I know we talked last week, they released Joshua Tree album. Week before that, they won a talent contest for $1,000. That was back when they were punk.
Ooh.
Yeah, instead of what they became later on, which was more, what did Warner Brothers Records call it? Don't call it punk, call it new wave. Good stuff. Let's see, moving forward to 1984, Van Halen's Jump peaked at number one in the U.S.
Bam.
Jump. Dun, 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 dun. Over the years, David Lee Roth has given various accounts of the meaning behind the lyrics, but most often it is said that they're about a TV news story he saw where a man was about to kill himself by jumping off a building. Think about that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you might as well
story
jump.
About a man who is possibly going to commit suicide. And you can just imagine David Lee Roth sitting there watching this on TV, drink in hand, just being like, jump! Go ahead! Jump! Just do it! Jump! That's all I'm doing.
Okay. I mean, I would have chimed in, but I don't think he wrote the bass line, so.
Just saying. If he wrote lyrics, he was advocating for somebody to kill themselves. That puts you in the mindset of David Lee Roth right there. Crazy, crazy dude. Speaking of crazy, crazy dudes.
Yes, the craziest, 1985, Richard Ramirez. Why are we talking about the Night Stalker, Brian?
Because
somebody thought it might have been AC/DC's fault. In 1985, Richard Ramirez murdered a woman in California and left his hat behind, which just happened to be an AC/DC hat.
As one does sometimes when they're murdering.
I don't know, honestly. From experience, I've never thought to myself, like, hey, if you murder someone, make sure you don't leave your hat behind. I've never entered my brain. Anyhow.
Just saying.
Then later, with an interview with a friend of Richard Ramirez, he brought up that Richard Ramirez's favorite band was, in fact, AC/DC, and his favorite song was Night Prowler, which is a song about sneaking into women's bedrooms, and according to AC/DC, about being a teenager and sneaking around on parents. However, it didn't go so well in the media, and the satanic panic was in full effect. So when Richard Ramirez later screamed out "Hail Satan" during his sentencing,
yes,
AC/DC was accused of being devil worshippers, and that kind of put the satanic panic straight into the path of heavy metal.
Man, that's kind of funny to think about. Like, because AC/DC does not come across to me as, like, devil worshippers.
Hell's bells, Brian.
I'm just
saying.
They're
on the highway to hell. What do you mean? They're obviously trying to get there.
I'm just saying. I was like, totally don't get it. I mean, considering the other bands that are out that could have possibly, like, been more of a contributor.
Dude.
I'm just saying. It's like, I mean, it was 1985 already.
That is true.
Moving up, skipping a bunch of decades here. 2010, Alex Chilton, singer and guitarist with Big Star, died in a hospital of heart problems in New Orleans at the age of 59.
Too young.
Now, do you know who Big Star is?
No.
That's the look that I was expecting.
Okay.
All right. So Big Star, I had no idea who they were until about a year ago, maybe even less than that. There's a documentary on Netflix called Big Star.
Okay.
And what it was is it was these group of guys, they got together and they started writing music and they started producing stuff and they started playing out in shows. So the record labels didn't get it and not a lot of fans got it either. Mm-hmm. Or like a lot of the normal people didn't get it. But the critics, they latched on to this band and they loved them. And other musicians heard them. Mm-hmm. And they loved them. So Big Star has become one of these bands that nobody knows about except for musicians and critics. And that's because their music was really amazing.
Yeah.
And you absolutely need to listen to it because it, go watch the documentary. It'll give you a great overview of what they started out with and when, even later on when they broke up and they moved into like solo stuff. Just good, good music, like way ahead of its time and complex and just interesting to listen to. So I cannot speak more highly of that documentary. You've got to go check it out. Big Star. It is on Netflix. I love watching music documentaries.
I noticed.
Yes, I'm very infatuated by those stories. But that will actually bring us to the end of the first half, unless you got something else for me, Jake. You got anything else?
No, I think we're going to save it for the second half.
Second half. All right. So we're done with the first half of the show where we get through our events of music history. I would just like to also say, If you like our show, you might like other shows on lineupmedia.fm. We've already mentioned a couple, including the Three Horsemen tonight. You can also enjoy such things as Surreal Talk, Cults, Conspiracies, and the Paranormal, which is a fan-frickin-tastic show. And on top of that, you can listen to This Day in History, hosted by Tony Hubert and Armand Kachigian. These two produce a daily show talking about what happened that day in music history. I've been trying to get on their show a little bit, you know, maybe promote my show a little bit. But the problem is that I don't get a lot of days where there's just like a ton of music history stuff that Armand would be interested in. So today I asked him, I was like, so are you going to talk about Mikado being released? And he's like, actually, yes. And I'm amazed that you have good taste. Seriously, this is what I work with. So, but even if Armand is kind of a tool, of which you are, you know it, Armand, he is a good guy and he very much knowledgeable about music or about history in general. So
with a name like Armand, he never had a chance. Come on.
Oh, man, he's actually really kind of cool. If you search for him on YouTube, you can find him competing on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where he won $500,000.
Congratulations.
He didn't get the million, but he did.
Well.
And a couple of other game shows, too, that he was on out in L.A. He's a doctor as well. Check out their show. It is quite good. But if you like part one, stick around for part two, because this is Follow the Sound. I am Brian Kroc, and along with me is Jacob Crum. Let's get on to part two.
Bam.